Hotel Dracula, something like that. Now, the point is that I want Vincent to me be good. It's just one part. So, go you Vincent dei go ho, right there. Then after that, you have Zao Dracula, and it's these little bits of stuff. Each one of those bits of stuff conveys something that's very important. The Zao conveys kind of then, like here we are at the end and there's the music on the soundtrack. Doc conveys that this sums up everything that we've talked about. Then there's the ge, which asserts. And so this machine's very reliable. The idea being, no, I don't want the sun, I don't want the moon, I don't want the stars. All I want is for Vincent to be good to me. So that's the ge. Then there's the la. The idea being that the reason that we're talking about this, the reason we're going through all this is, well, what I want is for Vincent to be good to me. So, zao, da, ge, la. Now, we might look at all that as giggling. Like, oh, they have all these assertive particles at the ends of their sentences because they're more expressive people than us. And obviously, that's ridiculous. This is grammar. That is part of speaking Cantonese. That sort of thing is very common in languages of this region. So, that is called... Those particles mark something that linguists call pragmatics. If you'd like to remember that, you can, but generally just look at how interesting they are. In any case, Cantonese has about 30 of those particles. Finally, in languages of this part of the world, there's something which is called numeral classifiers. And the way these work is that whenever you use a noun with a number, you have to add a little word that classifies what kind of noun it is for no particular reason other than that you just do. English has a little bit of this with something like two head of cattle. You can say two cows, two bulls. I guess you can't say two cattles. You have to say two head of cattle. It's kind of redundant. None of us assume that cattle had handles. Two head of cattle. But you do. But imagine if you had to do that for just any object instead of it being this archaic and peculiar construction that comes from the farm. So, for example, in Cantonese, there's the word tsum, which is used when you're talking about things that are flat. And so if yacht means one and toy means table, then to say one table, you don't just say yacht toy. Again, sorry, Cantonese speakers, for the bad or lack of tones. You have to say yacht tsum toy. So it's kind of like one flat of table, something like that. Then you do it with paper. And so ji is paper. So yat jeng ji, not just yat ji, that's baby Cantonese. Yat jeng ji, and you have to know. Then if something is round, then the numeral classifier is different. It's tsek. And so yat tsek gai dan, one egg, like one blob of egg. And then if it's a wristwatch, then that's also round, and so it's one blob of wristwatch. And so yat tsek tsao bu. And then if you have something that is long and thin, like for example a pen, a bat, then you have ji, and so yat ji bat. And if it's a flute, deck, then it's yat ji deck, and so on, and so on. Now, what's important is that you have dozens of these particles in Cantonese, and it gets to the point where it's not always so predictable what class something is going to be in, but you have to use them. And therefore, what this is a different way of having gender. Because these things are putting all of these nouns into these kinds of categories that we, with genderless, naked English, would never think of as being necessary. And yet that is part of speaking these languages. That is very common in Southeast Asia. Those are called numeral classifiers. And they are part of what make learning these languages difficult. Japanese has these as well. So, the point here has been to show that language gets really, really different. Talk about diversity of peoples and talk about diversity of cultures. Languages can be laid out on plans quite different than what Indo-European has us used to. This is the sort of thing that the language change process this series is about has produced.
Lecture 11, Language Families, Clues to the Past.
Depending on how you count it, there are at least some dozens and at most hundreds of language families in the world. So Indo-European is just one, although it's fairly widespread. And looking at how the other families are distributed across the world, you can learn a lot about the mists of human history and how our people have populated the planet. Austronesian is one interesting group in this way. Austronesian is spoken in Southeast Asia and then eastward of Australia in what's often called the South Seas. Austronesian is a huge family. There are 6,000 languages in the world, by many counts. About 1,000 of them are Austronesian. And Austronesian includes various subfamilies. The languages of the Philippines, like Tagalog, are Austronesian. Then Indonesian, which is a kind of fashioned version of Malay, is an Austronesian language. Both Tagalog and Indonesian have a whole mess of relatives that are very similar to them. And so we're talking about a big family, and these are just the big representatives. And then as you move into the South Seas area, then Fijian is an Austronesian language. Then there is the Polynesian subgroup, like Samoan and Hawaiian, the native Hawaiian language, and Tongan. Those are Austronesian languages. And there are a great many others. Now, one of the interesting things about Austronesian is that there is one of them that's spoken much further away than it's supposed to be. Over on Madagascar, there is an Austronesian language spoken. Now, Madagascar is quite close to Africa, and in Africa, there are completely different families of languages spoken. The Niger-Congo languages spoken just across the water from Madagascar in Africa have no relationship to Malagasy, which is spoken on that island. So it appears that as counterintuitive as it sometimes is to us, that there were people who had the technology and the fortitude and maybe the luck to sail with some kind of technology from Southeast Asia all the way to Madagascar. Why they did that, we don't really know. I can think of better things to do than that, but there were some people who were driven to do that. And apparently it was a successful voyage because these people populated that island. And it can even be shown that Malagasy is particularly related to Austronesian languages of Borneo in particular. So it's quite clear that there's a relationship and a very specific one. So it's rather wild. The word for stone in Tagalog is bato. The word for stone in Malay is batu. The word in Fijian is vatu. The word in Samoan is fatu. You can see a relationship between batu, bato, vatu, and fatu. They're clearly the same word having gone through its paces in different places. In Malagasy, it's vato. It's the last thing you would expect. A Martian could find that there was a weird relationship between Malagasy and the languages of Southeast Asia. The word for I in Malay, Tagalog, Fijian, and Samoan is mata. So that shows that they're a family. In Malagasy, it's maso. So it's different, but it's clearly related. So we know that the peoples of Madagascar have a historical relationship with, of all things, the people of Southeast Asia and the people in the various islands of Micronesia, Polynesia, and Melanesia, eastward of Australia, as well as New Zealand, where Maori is spoken, because their languages are much too similar for it to be an accident. Austronesian also teaches us a lesson in terms of how a language has spread and from where. We've seen how with Proto-Indo-European, there is the debate about whether it started in Turkey or the southern steppes of Russia. And with Austronesian, it's actually an easier call. And the reason it is because of a way that we can figure these things out based on comparing the degree to which the languages differ and where. What am I talking about? Well, there are in Austronesian four subfamilies. Before I mentioned a Philippine subfamily, etc., I was speaking informally then. In the technical sense, there are four main groups within the Austronesian family. These are the technical subfamilies. And what's interesting is that Three of those subfamilies are all spoken on the little island of Taiwan. Everything else, Philippines, Borneo, Sulawesi, Indonesian and its relatives, and then languages scattered around New Guinea, then the languages of Melanesia, Micronesia, and Polynesia, plus Malagasy, all those are one subfamily, although they're all quite different in many ways. Now, that's an interesting distribution because we have seen, and this is what it all comes down to, that languages always change. And we've seen that when a language family begins, then branches start when representatives of that family settle in different places. Now, we know that after a certain amount of time of separation, the languages that have emerged from this one language are going to be different to a certain extent, because they've all been changing in different directions. But then we know that as more time goes by, say another 2,000 years, those languages are not only going to be different, but more different, because more changes have been taking place over more time. Then as more time goes by, they're going to be even more different. So that's how these things go. That sheds some light on what's going on in Taiwan. If we have this family that is about 1,000 languages strong, and then you've got three of the families in Taiwan, and those families are very small, as it happens. There are only about a dozen of these languages that are alive on Taiwan. And then hundreds and hundreds of others are all still part of one subfamily. Then what that says is that Taiwan is where these languages are the most ancient. That means that in Taiwan, one language emerged, and that lots and lots and lots of time has gone by so that all of the languages there are extremely different from each other, so that you could have languages so different that they're three different subfamilies. Even though it's Taiwan, still, these are separate languages. And so Taiwan is not the size of this room. It's big enough to support different languages. And then it means that everywhere else, this settlement must have happened more recently. And the reason that the languages are so similar is because only so much time has gone by. So when you look at a group, what you look for is the area of the greatest diversity. It's assumed that that's where the language group began, because where the varieties are most different from each other, we can assume that they've been sitting there becoming different from each other the longest. So almost counterintuitively with Austronesian, we assume that it emerged on that little island and then spread out rather rapidly to all of these other places. So it begins on Taiwan, represented by mostly endangered languages there now. Then on the other hand, Polynesian languages are almost adorably close. When linguists are being taught how to do comparative reconstruction and historical linguistics, Polynesian is often used because the languages are so very close together. So, for example, Laos in Tongan is Kutu. In Samoan, it's Utu. And the U is a sound, this glottal stop, as we call it. We tend not to think of it as a sound because we don't write it, and it doesn't make a whole lot of difference in meaning. But for example, if I say, uh-oh, well, actually, there are glottal stops, the uh-oh, because I didn't say, oh, that's not English. You have to say, uh-oh. And so that is a sound. It plays a more central role in a lot of languages than it does in English. And so kutu, then in Samoan, it's utu. In Tahitian, it's utu. Maori, it's kutu. Hawaiian, uku. So clearly there's a relationship here. Lizard in Tongan is moko. In Samoan, it's mo'o. Tahitian, mo'o. Maori, moko. Hawaiian, mo'o. So these are very closely related languages. There aren't that many Polynesian languages either. Depending on how you count, there are about a couple of dozen of those languages. Now, when you see these languages being so similar to each other, this suggests that these would be newer languages within Austronesian, and archaeology does support that that's what's going on. There's evidence that Western Polynesia was settled between 1500 and 1200 BC, and the islands that are furthest from these originally settled Polynesian islands, like New Zealand, where Maori is spoken, and Hawaii, where Hawaiian is spoken, they seem to have been settled between 600 and 1000 AD. 1000 AD, that is just a couple of centuries before the signing of the Magna Carta. So, it seems that Polynesia would be the last bastion. This is the last place that Austronesian speakers happened to spread to, and that it all would have begun in Taiwan. And there's evidence that the peoples of Taiwan and the Polynesians have a cultural relationship. They use bark beaters to make clothes, for example. So based on a clue given to us by the languages, we can reconstruct not only that people are genetically related, but also we can reconstruct what the migration was just by looking at how different very obscure languages are on some island, and then looking at how very similar they are somewhere else, where, despite the fact that the people that we're talking about now have no way of knowing about or caring about each other unless they happen to learn about one another in books or on television. So Austronesian works in that way. Once you're armed with seeing that with Austronesian, you can see other kinds of movements of people. So, for example, the Bantu languages are spoken in Africa, and they cover a lot of the southern part of Africa. The Bantu languages are one subfamily within a grand family called Niger-Congo, but for our purposes, Bantu is the one that we care about. It's technically a sub-subfamily. The most famous member of Bantu is Swahili. That's the one that is taught often in this country, and it's used as a lingua franca, not across Africa, as is sometimes thought, but in certain countries in East Africa. Then there's also Zulu and Xhosa. Those are Bantu languages. But there are about 500 of them. It's been exaggeratedly said that if you know one, you know them all. No, but they are rather similar to each other. They're about as similar to each other as Romance languages or Slavic languages. And yet there are about 500. And they're spoken south of the Sahara. And as with Taiwan, with Austronesian, with Bantu, the area of the greatest diversity is in Cameroon and eastern Nigeria. So basically, you look at most of the Bantu languages, and they seem so akin that a relatively unknowing person would say that they're all the same. That, of course, is an unknowing statement, but they didn't pull that out of the air. They are almost bizarrely similar. If you know the basic grammar of one of the Bantu languages of Kenya, very little in one of them in South Africa is going to surprise you. It's just variations on a theme. That is not true when you go to Cameroon and eastern Nigeria, where you get some very different kinds of structures. So that tips you off, despite the fact that we're talking about movements that are not documented by writing and are documented only fitfully by archaeology, that it must have begun there. And it does appear, based on what archaeological evidence we have, that there did begin a migration there in 3000 BC. And that would explain why Swahili and Xhosa and Zulu and Kikuyu and Setswana and Sotho and Kikongo and all of the other Bantu languages are so similar. It means they've only been there for so long. And it appears that indeed they've only been there for a certain period of time. More evidence of that is if we look at another group of languages that are spoken in Africa, which is the Khoisan languages, which are often known as the Click languages. And they are distributed in a certain region of Southwest Africa. And what's interesting about them is, first of all, when you see a group that's confined in that way, you almost wonder, why are they just down there? One interpretation might be that they just grew in that area and then something stopped them from expanding. But groups have a way of expanding often. Then there's a little wrinkle about the Click languages, which is that most of them are spoken down in a particular southwestern region. But then there are a couple Click languages that are spoken up in Tanzania. This is completely separate from where these other ones are spoken. And in itself, it seems like a kind of a just-so story, but why are they spoken way up there? The first thing you think is that maybe one group of these people went all the way up to Tanzania. But why? People generally like their home, unless they're chased away. And why would it be just two groups that went all the way up to Tanzania, a foreign area, and stayed? If it was some sort of chasing, you'd assume that there'd be lots of different people and that maybe they'd be scattered all over the region. Instead, you have this enormous splotch and then ding, ding, up there. It's a little odd. It just makes you think. And another explanation for something like that is that maybe these people are, so to speak, the original coat of paint. And maybe it's actually that a group of people came down and dominated, exterminated, intermarried with, or otherwise negated the existence of these people in their original state. And that then what we see today are just the remnants of what was once a much broader distribution of these people. So suppose what it is that there was the Bantu migration that started from Cameroon and eastern Nigeria, and then they came down and gradually overtook what used to be a southern Africa that was covered to some extent with Khoisan speakers. It would appear that that is exactly what happened. There are various clues. In Bantu regions, some skulls that archaeologists have found are of the Khoisan type. The Khoisan people are rather small people physically, and they have certain characteristics of their skulls, which are pretty readily identifiable. And so some of these skulls have been found. More importantly, some of the Bantu languages that are spoken near the Klik languages have Klik languages themselves. And so back in the 70s, I remember as a kid, there was a kind of a furore over Miriam Makeba, who would sing with Kliks. She was a Bantu language speaker, but languages like Zulu and Xhosa have the Kliks in them. Now, most Bantu languages don't have Kliks, and Kliks are not something that you see arising in languages spontaneously. They're a very, very peculiar feature of the Klik languages, except some of the Bantu languages that happen to be around them. That suggests that Bantu itself does not have these Kliks, but that as time went by, some Bantu speakers met people like this, and there was some sort of intermixture, and so they picked up the Kliks from them. But that implies that they came into an originally different situation. And so it seems that this is one of many situations where we can see that there has been an overrunning of one group by another. And it starts with the diversity of Bantu languages at a particular point, and then the slightly odd distribution of the Khoisan languages. The Tanzanian group are just kind of a chance island. It's kind of like a few flies are going to get caught in the screen or something like that. You almost expect that there are going to be some that happen not to have been overrun outside of that main region. And that's what seems to have been the case. Another case like that actually is Basque, which straddles France and Spain. And Basque is a language that has no known relatives in the world. There are various languages like that in the world. Basque is one of them. It's not related to Indo-European at all, and it's not related to anything else. It is assumed for various reasons that languages related to Basque probably were spoken over a wide swath of Europe, and that then there was a migration into Europe of Indo-European speakers, which largely overran them except in their one current redoubt. And so, this is the way language groups seem to have spread. It's thought that originally there may have been a great many more language families in the world, but that as technology and agricultural revolutions even before that have allowed people or driven people to move on and to conquer and to take over land, that this has meant that some groups have spread very much at the expense of others. And that Khoisan pattern of dots surrounded by something larger, or the Basques, is common in the world, and it seems to attest to a certain general tendency in human migrations. Now, when you notice this kind of thing, then certain things start to seem a little odd. It's the kind of thing that you can easily not notice, but if you've decided on one pattern, then certain things that don't fit it might be telling you something. One of them is the Native American languages. So the Native American languages of the New World were once very numerous. It's estimated that in North America there were 400 of these languages spoken before Europeans came, and about 670 in Central and South America. That's an awful lot of languages, and from what we know, they were not closely related. So this was not a bunch of Bantus or a bunch of Romance languages. This was just a delirious kaleidoscopic riot. That is what was there. And the distribution of these languages poses a little bit of a problem. And it's for this reason. There is increasing evidence that maybe North America was not populated exclusively by people coming over the Bering Strait. But it's so tentative at this point that I'm going to sidestep it, and we're going to assume that the way that North America was populated was when people came from Asia over the Bering Strait into Alaska and came down. Assuming that that's true, and genetic evidence at this point is showing that that could easily have been true. The genetics and the archaeology are beginning to match up better and better. Then what we would expect is that up there near the Bering Strait, there would be this huge clump of languages that have been diverging forever, difficult to classify, ridiculously different from each other. In other words, it should be Taiwan or Cameroon up there in Alaska and around there. Then as you go down, it ought to be that in South America, you've got a bunch of Swahilis. Or in South America, you've got a bunch of, it's like Russian and Polish and Ukrainian, different, but all kind of alike. But that's not the way it is. Actually, when you were up in Alaska and Canada, if you look at Native American languages, what you actually have is these two families, these two big fat families, Eskimo, Aleut, and Na-Dene. None of them have all that many languages in them. And as a result, there's almost a certain monotony in that region. It's then when you go down that all of a sudden you get the patchwork of color. And so the diversity is down, particularly in places like California and in South America. But the problem is that it's very difficult to conceive of how the migration could have begun at Tierra del Fuego or in California and then spread from there. It really seems like it would have been through the Bering Strait. So that is a conundrum that not enough people had actually thought about, but for those who had thought about it, it shows something about human migration. The only explanation for why way up there there would be so few languages is if something intervened. Something must have stopped languages from growing up there while people had gotten down lower and their languages had started flowering the way languages are supposed to. And what's interesting is that climate history helps us here. It would appear, based on the way people are looking at this now, that the last ice age came in after people had already begun crossing and drove these people away, so that the area was only repopulated after the thaw that created the conditions that we're still living in. But that would have been later. And so the reason that there aren't that many interesting language divergences up in that region is because the people who are there now are the descendants of people who got there later than the people who were already down in California and in South America and doing what language people do. You wouldn't have a clue to think about that if you didn't notice how the languages were distributed. When you've got these two big, fat, rather empty families up top and then the riot on the bottom, and yet you know that it all started up top, then you've got a conundrum that has to be solved. And it appears to have been. The genetic evidence, as it happens, correlates almost ridiculously nicely with the idea of the people up there being later arrivals. Who would have known to even look for that if the languages didn't help us to figure it out? So, looking at things like that, we can also deduce answers to questions that some people have dismissed. There was a sport for a while, particularly in the late 1800s, of trying to figure out what the first language would have been like. And people had all these theories about how it would have started with barking like a dog or gurgling like a child. And it was all very speculative. Not as many languages were known back then, so if you tried to reconstruct from the ones that were living, you were going to come up with something kind of hokey. And there was actually a formal ban put on discussing the subject at one point because it just didn't seem to lead anywhere. We probably will never know what that first language was to the extent that we do, say, Proto-Indo-European, as we'll shortly see why. But there are things that we can know if we kind of put on our thinking caps and look at certain strange things and we deduce from principles. So, for example, the Khoisan languages. They have clicks, and that is so exotic to us, and justifiably so, that your natural assumption would be, well, they must all be kind of like the Romance languages. Clicks, that's a likeness, so they're all alike. And that is a very natural thing to think. There are about 50 of the Khoisan languages. And actually, other than the clicks, they are not alike. And they're understudied, but as more and more is learned about them, it's clear that some of them are languages with case endings like Latin. They conjugate their nouns, so to speak. Some of them are a lot more like Chinese. Trying to find cognate words in them, like the whole herba business that we saw with Latin and Romance, it's very hard. There's some, but not nearly as many as you might expect. And it's not that they've borrowed lots of words from surrounding languages. These are rather insular people. It's that the words are so divergent. And as is so typical, most of those languages are dying. There's a danger that we're going to lose a lot of information just by not getting in there in time. But these are very, very divergent languages. They have their cliques, but other than that, it's clear that they've been there for a very, 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 very long time. Then you start thinking about other things. People did begin in Africa, and people began kind of little. And so Lucy, and it's not certain now that Lucy is actually a woman, but whatever Lucy was, Lucy is little. Now, of course, Lucy goes further back than the genus Homo, but early hominids were kind of small. We've gotten bigger and bigger. Well, the people who speak Khoisan languages physically are rather small, and their culture is clearly very, very ancient. And it's often been thought, especially recently, that it may be that these are descendants of the first people and that their language would be a descendant of the first language. And if that's true, it allows us to get rid of something which is otherwise a highly intractable problem, which is, where did those cliques come from? It's one of those things. It's easy to figure out that if you have a word Apa in your language, that as time goes by, it might become Abba. That makes some sense. It's easy to think that if you have a word in your language like snusos, that after a while you might start saying nuso. That makes sense. But why in the world, if you had a word like hara in your language, would eventually you start saying hara? And if even that happened, why would then later you go hara? Why would there be 48 of those? How would it start? And it's easy to think, well, we must lack imagination, ethnocentric, blah, 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 blah. But it hasn't happened anywhere else in the world. There are a very few other examples of cliques happening other than expressive things, you know, how to call a lizard or a children's game. But that doesn't count. We all do that. There is a language only used with mothers-in-law in one of the Aboriginal languages of Australia, Lardal, which had cliques. And that's really it. And even there, it's kind of a marginal language where something funny is going on. It's a way of speaking. But other than that, languages don't have cliques. There is no language spoken in the hills of Thailand that has cliques. There is no European language where people are running around clicking. There is no Amazonian language where people click. It's a very odd thing. And given that you can almost always figure out how something else started, one way to sweep that problem under the rug, and that's really what it is to say, well, the first language had cliques, and one thing that it's much easier to imagine is letting those cliques go. And so if your language is hara, you can imagine that as time went by, you might want to just say hara, especially if it happens that other people are learning your language non-natively. What's the first thing that's going to go? It's those cliques. They are very, very hard to learn non-natively. So that's easy. So suppose that the first language had the cliques, and then as time went on, that got dropped out and languages developed all sorts of other bizarre things. And the evidence starts to seem clearer and clearer that these languages are very old. So, for example, not only are the Khoisan languages down in that core southwestern region very different, but the ones up in Tanzania are extremely different not only from them, but from each other. Clearly, there is a great antiquity going on here. So it may be that the cliques languages are descendants of the first language, but they're two things. They're already so different that it would be quite a challenge to figure out what proto-language they traced to, although that would be an interesting task for an intrepid person. But then we have to remember that that language would presumably have been being spoken for many, many, many millennia. And so it's probably, except for the cliques, if we assume that the cliques were originally there, extremely different from whatever the first language would have been. But one thing we might know about the first language is that it might have had cliques. And if it did, then that makes it a lot easier on historical linguists who now are largely free of having to figure out how those clicks started, or at least the problem becomes less urgent. So this is how the distribution of language families can tell us things about history which otherwise would be hard to uncover or which we only have hints of from other sources.
Lecture 12, The Case Against the World's First Language.
This is a lecture about something which a lot of you may have read about in the media, which is that there have been claims that words from the first language have been discovered. These are claims that come from a small number of linguists, and an issue of the Atlantic Monthly was devoted to it some years ago. It pops up in the New York Times now and then. And the linguists in question, mainly, are Joseph Greenberg of Stanford University. He is now the late Joseph Greenberg, but he was a pioneer in classifying, for example, the languages of Africa. He was a towering figure in terms of other linguistic ideas that he pioneered. But he's probably become best known for the proto-world theory. His legacy is being carried on by Merritt Rulin, who is an independent scholar. And the proto-world hypothesis flutters on the edge of linguistic debate, often dismissed. The work is covered with interest in the media, but most linguists who have examined it have vehemently rejected it. And it's tempting to think, especially as an interested layman, and the way the newspaper stories tend to be pitched, that this is an example of the pioneer, the Ferdinand de Saussure, basically, who has an idea that is promising but not yet proven in a rock-solid way, and all of the blinkered, hide-bound colleagues are incapable of understanding this, incapable of opening up their minds to it, kind of like the man who discovered continental drift, von Wegener, etc. Everybody laughed at him, and then it turned out that the continents had drifted. Yet, the fact is that if you look at the evidence for proto-world, the fact is that even with your best attempt, and of course what I really mean is my best attempt at an unbiased judgment, it's hard to see things the way Greenberg did and the way Rulin does, at least precisely the way they do. Now, I've been told that in making these tapes that I'm supposed to move around more. So now I'm going to step out here. I'm going to talk from here. I've moved. So, the fact is that as far as Greenberg and Rulin's work goes, despite the fact that I'm disinclined to think of things exactly the way they do, I would also have to say that the response of many linguists to their work has been reflexively contemptuous to a degree that has rather frightened me. And if anything, coming up in the field and watching the faces go red and the body posture get defensive at the very mention of Merritt Rulin or proto-world tipped me off that these guys might be onto something. Usually when people are that upset about it, there's some sort of sense of threat or at least a shattering lack of imagination. So I've tried to look at these things, and I've written here and there about what I thought. This lecture is going to be the critical one. This lecture is going to be what I think the layman should watch out for the next time the New York Times writes about this. The next lecture will be showing what is good about their work and what is promising about their work, some of which has neither made the Times nor reputable linguistics journals, partly because it's hard for Merritt Rulin to get published in reputable linguistics journals, and partly because sometimes I think he hides his light beneath a bushel to an unseemly extent. So this is my attempt to be as fair as possible on this subject. Now, the idea is that there is this handful of words, or I guess it would be several handfuls, or depending on how big your hands are, or whatever, of words that have been reconstructed that are supposedly the first words, the words of Adam and Eve, or whatever you want to call it. And the idea has been that this can be reconstructed by looking at words in hundreds of languages and using those same techniques of deduction that we use with Proto-Indo-European partly, but where written sources don't exist or we only know so much about the language family, just using a kind of an intelligent eyeballing strategy. The idea being, well, it looks like that, well, then probably it comes back to this. And if that's all that you have available, maybe that's what you have to do. But the first problem, first thing that we have to think about is, let's say that 150,000 years ago, you've got a word. You know, who knows what the word is? Kabibble. Now, given the way words change shape, we've seen our whole snusos to nu issue, why is it that 150,000 years later, or even 80,000 years later, or whenever you think that language began, why would any word still be recognizable? If you're always having this constant turnover, why would there be any that would kind of sit there like diamonds in the mine? And you have to think about even humble cases, like the word for bread in Spanish is pan, in Russian it's chleb, in Greek it's psomi. And these are related languages in a family where there's only been so much divergence. So why in the world would anything stay? And what we want to demonstrate is an example of this that is something other than Indo-European, because I think it's truly a beautiful thing. Algonquian languages are one group of Native American languages, and they include Cree and also Cheyenne, which is spoken in Montana and Oklahoma. Algonquianists are a subclass of linguists. They've done as much work on reconstruction as Indo-Europeanists have, and they have reconstructed quite a bit of what they call, not Proto-Indo-European, but Proto-Algonquian. And it's a nice compact group of languages. It's a fun field. They have reconstructed that the Proto-Algonquian word for winter was peponwi. So P-E-P-O-N-W-I, peponwi. That's a nice word. Now, the same word in Cheyenne is not something like pebon or something like peony or something like that. It's ah, literally that. It's a long A with a catch in the throat. Ah. So, peponwi, ah. And believe it or not, peponwi became ah step by step, because this is how sound change happens. Only over 1,500 years. These are the steps. So you start with peponwi. Now, things that are hanging at the end, especially when they're vowels, or vowely sounds like W and Y, are fragile. So, name begins as name. Well, peponwi first became pepon. That little part dropped off. That's normal. Now, we've seen how H's tend to drop away. Some consonants drop away a lot less than H, but you never know in a language when they're going to gang up on a particular consonant. In some languages, it'll be this consonant that's weak. In some languages, it'll be another. In Proto-Algonquian, there was this strange P problem. And so P's dropped out in particular cases. So, pepon, that was nice. But then after a while, eon, and the P's were gone. And it's pretty easy to see, peponwi, pepon, eon. If you know how that worked, the relationship between peponwi and eon is clear to us, although we're already getting pretty far away. Vowels shift around. Bad, bad. Well, eon, ain. That was the next step. The vowels just move. You know it's not going to stay eon. It became ain. There's that n hanging on the end, and n's are often rather fragile. So, after a while, instead of ain, ai. Some people talked funny and they just said ai. Pretty soon nobody said ain anymore. So, ai. Peponwi, ai. Now, sometimes vowels get longer. In this case, there was a little glottal stop in between. Ai, 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 ai. That was next. And so we start with peponwi, ai. Then that changed to ai. Then that e at the end dropped off. Ah. So, peponwi. So, peponwi, pepon, eon, ain, ai, 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 ai. And there you go. 1,500 years. That's how sound change works. And so now you read the New York Times, the first words. But if the first word, for example, is peponwi, and then 1,500 years later in a language it can be ah, well then who knows what it's going to be 100,000 years later. So that's the first thing that you have to think about. But getting closer up to what the proto-world people are actually doing, nevertheless they insist Maybe it's just that certain words do stay pristine. Maybe it's just chance. Maybe it's just the roll of the dice. Not every word is going to be a peponui. Maybe not. So, for example, one of their most famous reconstructions is that apparently tik, T-I-K, was the original word for one or maybe finger, the idea being that you count one with your finger. And how do they know? Well, you can look at languages of the world, and I suppose that you could detect a certain coalescence around something like tik. So, for example, in Sudan, there's a language called Dinka. Their word for one is tok. Then in Turkish, the word for only, and that's kind of like one, is tek. And then, well, in Old English, the word for toe was tahe. And toe, maybe that's like finger. And then in Japanese, te means hand, which is close to the finger. And then in Southern Tasmanian, if we can trust the documents, the word for forefinger was motuk. And you go on and on like this. In one Eskimo variety, the word for index finger is tiki. And then in Latin, you have digitus. And remember, T and D are related, and K and G are related. So digitus is kind of like saying tikitus. And so maybe there's a tik there, and so on. So you look at all these languages, and there's all this tickness. And you think, well, maybe that traces back to tik. Now, the problem is here that in terms of tracing back, writing has only existed for 6,000 years. I would say language has probably existed for 150,000. Some people would say 50,000. I think they're wrong now. Maybe eventually when they acknowledge that the Big Bang has been misdated, they'll say that it's 80,000, but a very, very long time. 6,000 is a little fraction. Most people would say that if language had only existed for 24 hours, then writing would have been invented after 11 o'clock p.m. So that's how new writing is in terms of language. So if we're going to be tracing back to the very first thing, then we've got an awful lot of non-writing time involved. And so we can't do the very careful comparative reconstruction based on written documents that you can do to get, say, Snusos. Because there, not only do you have Hindi, but then you can go back to Sanskrit, which is basically not truly a spoken language anymore, but we certainly got many written records. Then you've got these proto-languages, and then you can trace back from that another step to this hypothetical language. But here we're going way, way back. Now, Rulin has a very useful objection along these lines. He knows that this is a problem, but he has written that we're expecting too much, that comparative reconstruction of that kind can only go as far back as writing, but that we're being somewhat timid and unimaginative in insisting that that's as far back as we can ever reconstruct anything. And on that, he does have a point. One quote he has, under acknowledged, but which I think is perfectly put, is the following. Were a biologist to demand a complete reconstruction of proto-mammal, together with a complete explanation of how this creature evolved into every living mammal, before he would accept the fact that human beings are related to cats and bats, he wouldn't be taken seriously. Yet, it's just this kind of linguistic nonsense that's been taught in universities by Indo-Europeanists for so long that most linguists are unaware of its mythological nature. So, that is an important point. We do not need to know exactly what the first mammal was like. We don't need to have a fossil record of every single little step between that mammal and the raccoon to understand that there is a such thing as the mammalian family, that there are certain relationships, and to know that that proto-mammal existed, and even to have a certain idea of what that mammal would have been like. We happen to know that proto-mammal was a kind of a small, smelly, shrew-like thing that was running away from dinosaurs. We have that in the record. But actually, even if we didn't know that, we could reconstruct something like that from looking at what mammalian record we have before those creatures came along. So, okay, that's nice. But then we get back to this tick business, and we really think about what we're doing. And what we have to think about is that languages often have chance resemblances between words that are always kind of cute and kind of funny, and it's often quite a few of them. And you have to be able to distinguish the accident from what actually has some sort of historical meaning. So, for example, Japanese, which is spoken in Japan, and English are not related in any serious way. No one is exactly sure what Japanese is related to. It might be related to the Altaic family that includes Turkish and Mongolian. And if Japanese is part of that, then so is Korean. But we're not sure, and it's a distant relationship. Japanese is not only on an island by itself, but linguistically, it is kind of an oddity. And then English, we've learned, is part of Indo-European. So no close relationship, nor have they been geographically contiguous. To the extent that there's been any exchange, it's been rather recently because of technology and because of travel. But in terms of the gut bucket levels of the language, there's no relationship. And yet, in Japanese, mo means more, just like mo, more. Like that, so. Well, we have so, like just so. Sagaru is to hang down. Sagaru, we have sag. Nai is not. We could guess that that word nai means not, because it sounds kind of like our not or our na or something like that. Mono is a thing, a single entity. Mono, mano, so mano and one. Miru is to see. Mirror. So if we're going to have this relationship between one and finger and only, well, then what about seeing and the fact that you see in a mirror? Miru. Taberu is to eat. Well, it sounds kind of like a Japanese person saying table. Taberu, eat, and you eat at a table, so maybe there's some sort of relationship. Hot in Japanese is atsui. So atsui. If you watch a Japanese person wringing their hands and going, atsui, you don't have to wonder, because not only the wringing of the hands after they burnt themselves, but also just atsui sounds kind of like hot. And hito is a man. Well, he. We have he, and he's are generally men. There's a little emphatic particle, yo, in Japanese. You can often, you listen to Japanese people speaking, you'll often hear that yo at the end of things. Blah, 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 da, yo, yo, yo. Well, we have yo. Emphatic particle. Maybe there's a relationship. Ku is to feed your face. It's often used referring to men shoving, I guess, sushi into their mouths. Ku sounds kind of like our chu, chu, and so on. You could go on and on and on with this in Japanese. It's kind of like a little game. You can do that between a lot of languages. And so, for example, the words, what is it? Fai in Thai means fire. Tai in Thai means tire. Rim in Thai means rim. All of those things by accident. And so, you always have those little things to deal with. So if you're looking at all of this tick business, the fact is that we can assume that between the world's 6,000 languages, there are going to be these accidental resemblances in certain cases. You can look at tick and you can think, well, there you go, there must be something going on. But of course, that tick thing, or something that sounds a little different, like dig or talk or talk or all these other things, those things are just one of course, tens of thousands of words in all of these languages. So how do we know that we're not dealing with a big conglomeration of hitos and yos and taberus and things like that? So it's something that one has to think about. A language can only have so many kinds of syllables in the end. Some languages allow more kinds than others. Some languages have more consonant clusters. Some languages can have more vowels together. But there's no language where you can have 16 consonants at a time. There's a limit. And there's no language where you can have 7 vowels just running after each other. There's a certain general template where consonants and vowels kind of do a little dance together, and there are only so many sounds that the mouth can make. The clicks expand it, but most languages don't make use of those clicks. So eventually, you're going to coalesce on certain T's and P's and da's and K's. That's what you would expect. The issue is whether that happens enough for a pattern to be there. And if we have cases like English and Japanese, which are normal, then the eyeballing strategy, where you're thinking, well, this looks kind of like this, and this looks kind of like that, and it means something kind of like this, the accumulation of this might not be good science. And that's something that a lot of linguists have argued. But to look a little bit more closely at how these things go, there are also some outright data problems. So one way of going about this for them is to look at data from hundreds of languages. And to their credit, it is hundreds. They don't just look at 16. They Greenberg in particular, as a graduate student, I remember one of the main things that he used to do. You used to see him. He got older and older, but he would always be going to Green Library, and he would always have this big stack of grammars, and he'd be going through them. And that's what he did. That's not something that most linguists today are trained to do or would be inclined to do. Often you'd be looking for a grammar yourself for some project you were doing, and it wouldn't be there. And you could almost guess who else would want a description of this language but Greenberg. And you could go up to his table and find it in the stack. So these people were diligent, and Merritt Rulin does the same thing. But it's not just a matter of looking at hundreds of languages at a time. These people are responsible. The idea is to look at the proto-languages. So just like with Indo-European, you go to Sanskrit, and people who are Indo-Europeanists are really into their Sanskrit and their old Church Slavonic, which is the early Slavic, the earliest Slavic language that we know. And you go a lot from them rather than from looking at French and looking at Hindi. You want to start as far back as possible because we know what those languages were like. In the same way, ideally, proto-world people look at proto-languages. So the idea is to look at proto-Indo-European or proto-Austronesian, etc., and to try to trace back to the original language from there, because presumably there would be less distance between these proto-languages and the original one. But then when you look at the proto-language data, there's some problems. And so, for example, the word for water in this little proto-world collection is acqua. That's a little suspicious anyway. That's practically what it is in Italian now. Why would it stay the same? They've never answered that question. Why in Italy would this one word stay the same? Is it because of the sun there? You know, is it because the Roman Empire was successful? You know, is it because they have good food and so they value their water? Obviously, there's no reason. As soon as you know that the proto form is aqua, to me, I know that's wrong. It's certainly not going to be that. But let's pretend that it was. So they have taken 12 proto languages and they have come up with all of the roots that would have been water. And Rulin is rhetorically good, and at one point he says that if the untutored person, I don't remember whether he says a Martian or an untutored person, looked at these 12 forms, they would figure out that the proto-world form was aqua. But then you actually look at the forms. The forms are the following, and all you have to do is listen to them. Ka, ki, engi, aqua, let's, ah. Niru, ak-a, o-a, namao, ojo, gugu, aqua. Those are the forms, and you can look at all 12 of them on the page. Now, really, a lot of these things don't sound anything like aqua. Nki does not sound like it to me. Gugu sounds like water gurgling, I suppose, but that doesn't sound like aqua to me, just because g is kind of like k. There are only so many sounds. Niru, to me, doesn't sound like anything. And so they're not that alike, and you might think that k-ah is one of them. But all of this is kind of stretching it. But to give them their due, out of all of these proto-language forms, there are four of them which are oddly similar. And that is the ones that are aqua, 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 and o-ah. And that last one, that's a very difficult sound to make. But you look at these and you think, well, that is similar. Now, any linguist who looks at those four forms and says, well, that just must be an accident, is not thinking very hard. No, it's not an accident. And so why do those four look so alike? Well, actually, as it turns out, aqua, aqua, and o-a are from Proto-Indo-European, and we can understand how in Proto-Indo-European it might be aqua, and then a family called Afro-Asiatic and another one called Caucasian. Afro-Asiatic is a big fat family. For our purposes, suffice it to say that it includes Semitic, which includes Hebrew and Arabic. It also includes some languages of North Africa and some languages of Ethiopia. But for our purposes, Semitic. And those are languages which are rubbing up cheek by jowl with Indo-European languages, and particularly would have been when Indo-European had not spread to Western Europe and into India. Then there are Caucasian languages which are spoken in the Caucasus Mountains. They're small languages. They're so complex, many of them, that I think it's cruelty to children to make them learn them, but they've been doing it for thousands of years. And they're very interesting. They're also near the Indo-European languages. And so wouldn't it be typical that these language families might share words? As we'll see later in the series, borrowing is part of how languages work. And so it could be that these words are so similar because of that. Once you step away from there, you're getting these Nirus and these Gugus, which really are not similar in any way that you would have noticed unless you were trying very hard to make a case that there was some sort of proto-word Akwa. And so there's only one other one, other than these that are all clustered in the Fertile Crescent Middle East region, and that's Akwa. And that one is reconstructed as a